From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. Professor Jack Copeland is a leading expert on Alan Turing, but last time he visited Bletchley Park, it was to talk to a packed teleprinter hall about another code-breaking genius. This time he looked into how computers were used against Hitler. Max Newman ran a section named after him, the Newmanry, which focused on the strategic, high-level cipher Hitler was using to communicate with his high command, Lorenz.
Max never worked on Enigma. He attacked this entirely different machine, which the British codenamed the Tunny Machine. There is a real Tunny machine here in Bletchley Park. You can go and gaze at it in awe, if you like, in Block B, where it's got a huge red German flag with a swastika on hanging behind it. It looks very striking. You can't miss it if you go to Block B. Enigma was sort of old technology by the time the war started. The Enigma machine was invented, you know, kind of like 20 years or more before the war. It was really kind of slow and clunky and only just about suitable for the purposes that the German military wanted to use it for. It needed an enormous number of people in order to encrypt and decrypt a message using Enigma. You needed three operators at each end of the link. There was the cipher operator who would type the German plain text at the keyboard of the Enigma machine. And as the cipher clerk typed at the keyboard, letters would light up at the lamp board. And the cipher clerk would type the plain text, the German message, and then the letters of the cipher text would light up at the lamp board. The cipher clerk had an assistant who wrote down the letters of cipher text painstakingly one by one as they appeared at the lamp board. And then the third player was the radio operator. Once the coded message was completely written out in the cipher clerk's notebook, that would then be passed on to the radio operator, and the radio operator would convert it into Morse code, and it would be transmitted over the radio link to the receiving Enigma unit, where they'd be counterparts of those three people. The cipher clerk would type out the Enigma message in the encoded form on the keyboard of his machine, and the German plain text would light up at the lamp board of the receiving machine. So six people to encode a single message. It was slow, it was clunky, there was obviously room for improvement. And improvement did come with this machine, the Tunny machine, which entered the war in 1941. It was sort of custom built by German scientists for use by the German military to encrypt their messages. The Germans called it the SZ-40, and it was built by the German engineering company Lorenz. You can see the wheels of the machine. Enigma had three wheels, or later models had four wheels. You can see the wheels of the Tunny machine here, 12 of them standing kind of side by side like plates in a dish rack or something. If the wheel count is a crude estimate of the complexity of a machine, then that immediately tells you that the Tunny machine is much more complex than the Enigma machine. Three wheels versus 12 wheels. It required only one operator at each end of the link compared to the Enigma's three. The sending operator connected the Tunny machine to a teleprinter. It was a teleprinter attachment. And then the operator would type the message in plain German at the teleprinter keyboard. The Tunny machine would encrypt it. And then instead of Morse being involved, the Tunny machine's output, encrypted teleprinter code, went straight to air and was received by a Tunny unit hundreds of miles away, perhaps. The listening operators at the British Y stations, who spent their lives, you know, glued to their headphones listening to German transmissions, they spoke of hearing a strange new music when Tunny first went on the air. No one had heard it before. It was the sound of binary teleprinter code being transmitted at high speed. Teleprinter code is very much like the binary code in today's computers. It's just zeros and ones, ons and offs. And that's what they heard, binary code being transmitted at very high speeds. The Lorenz company had managed to automates so much of the encoding process that under normal conditions of operation, neither the sending operator nor the receiving operator would ever see the ciphertext, the enciphered form of the German message. With Enigma, you know, they handled the ciphertext. They watched the ciphertext appear at the lamp board. But the Tunny operators never even saw the ciphertext. As far as they were concerned, plain German went in, plain German came out at the other end. It was a very sophisticated system. The first Tunny radio link went on the air in 1941 between Berlin and Greece. And it was kind of an experiment, first use of the Tunny machine. It was very successful. The Germans liked what they saw. And immediately, a network of Tunny links began to grow up, spanning Europe and North Africa. It's kind of a harbinger of today's mobile phone networks. So there were large fixed exchanges in Berlin and Königsberg. Berlin handled the Western links, and Königsberg handled the Eastern links to the Russian front. And there were large fixed exchanges in some other cities, for example, Paris. But most of the Tunny units were mobile, and they just followed the battlefronts as they moved about. A mobile Tunny unit consisted of two trucks. One truck contained the radio equipment, and the other truck contained two Tunny machines, one for transmitting, one for sending, and it also contained the associated teleprinter equipment used in conjunction with the Tunny machines. There was a difference, a crucial difference between Tunny and Enigma in terms of the use of the machines. Enigma was kind of used for everything. You know, a lot of the traffic was very low level. Tunny traffic was, on the other hand, very high level. It was used by Hitler and the German army top brass in Berlin to communicate with the generals and the field marshals who were actually running the war at the various battlefronts. So if you could break into Tunny, then you would be able to pretty much listen to what the German generals and field marshals were saying to each other over breakfast about the course of the war. What strategy were they going to use in this particular battle? How many tanks have they got? How many reinforcements could they bring up? What would they do if the Russians made such and such a counter move? All this information was going back and forth on Tunny. To break into it would be to win the war. It was as simple as that. Incidentally, the British gave each of these links a kind of fishy name. I don't know why they chose Tunny and the various fishy names for this particular type of code, but they did. Jellyfish, for example, between Paris and Berlin, and there's herring from Rome to Tunis, and there's turbot out to the Russian front, and gurnard, and squid, and octopus, and so on. So how did the Tunny machine work? Suppose the first letter of the plain text is P. So the first letter that the Tunny operator types is a P. As you know, when you press a key on a modern computer keyboard, circuitry in the keyboard generates a series of zeros and ones in ASCII code, typically nowadays, whereby a particular keyboard letter, maybe an A, will be associated with a series of seven zeros and ones. Each keyboard letter has its own unique pattern of seven zeros and ones in ASCII code, and those zeros and ones kind of flow into the inside of the machine, and stuff happens with them. The teleprinter keyboard was very similar. It didn't work with a 7-bit code like ASCII. It worked with a 5-bit code. And each keyboard letter had its own representation in teleprinter code. So P is 01101. That's kind of P translated into teleprinter code, that particular package of five zeros and ones. And every letter, another keyboard character, had its own unique package of five zeros and ones. That was teleprinter code. It was widely used all around the world at that time. There was nothing secret about it. Every engineer would know teleprinter code. It was used for telegrams, telex, and many other applications. What the Tunny machine did was encrypted teleprinter code. That was what it was all about. There are 12 Tunny wheels, and they divide into three groups. There are the motor wheels, which are the two wheels in the middle, and then what Bletchley Park called the Psi wheels, there were five of them, and then the Chi wheels, there were five of them as well. The motor wheels were kind of dull. Their function was just to make code wheels move. So I won't say anything more about the motor wheels. The Chi wheels and the Psi wheels were the guts of the Tunny machine. And essentially what the Tunney machine did was laid down two layers of encryption on the German plain message. One layer of encryption generated by the psi wheels and a second layer of encryption generated by the chi wheels. And these layers consisted of sort of random letters, obscuring letters that were added to the German text. So you start off with plain German letters, Wetter für die Nacht or whatever, and then letters would be streamed out by the chi wheels and added to those plain German letters. And so you'd end up with an encrypted form of the message. And then more random letters would be streamed out by the psi wheels, and they would be added to what you'd already got. So you ended up with the German message with two layers of encryption on top of it, the encryption provided by the chi wheels and the encryption provided by the psi wheels. And then once the encrypted form had gone through the psi wheels, then it just went to radio and was transmitted. So what's this business about adding letters to letters? Well, this was all done at the bit level. It was zeros and ones being added to zeros and ones. That's how letter addition worked. You just added up the teleprinter representations of the letters. And the addition rules that they used, and they only needed rules for zero and one, because binary, they were just zero and one. The addition rules will be quite familiar to you, quite obvious. Zero plus zero equals zero. Zero plus one equals one. 1 plus 0 equals 1. It's all obvious so far. And then the fourth and final Tunney addition rule was that 1 plus 1 equals 0. You'd think, oh, well, that's crazy, that's wrong. Why did they use that? But it was very handy. The engineers chose that as their fourth addition rule because it meant that if you added a letter once, then you produced, you know, some masked letter. But then if you added that same letter again, the plain text would appear. So the result of adding a letter twice using those Tunney addition rules had no effect. So if you take X and then you added M to X, say, then you'd get a masked form of X. And then if you added M again to the masked form, you'd end up back with X. So that's how decryption worked. They'd plaster on these obscuring layers of letters, transmit to the distant link, and then they'd add those same obscuring letters to the ciphertext, and the plain text would pop out. And it was just because of that curious feature of the fourth addition rule, that 1 plus 1 equals 0, that that all worked, that you could decipher in that way. So if you press the P, then its teleprinter representation went into the first adder. The chi wheels produced the first letter of the first obscuring layer, which is M in this case, and in the adder, M and P were added together by the circuits, and that produces R. So that's just how it is with teleprint code. If you add the teleprint representation of M to the teleprint representation of P, it just is the case that the 5-bit string that you end up with is the teleprint representation of R. So R is like the half-enciphered form of the first letter of the message. It's got one layer of encryption on top of it, and it's moving down the line, ready to have the second layer of encryption put on. So it goes into the next adder. The psi wheels produce their letter, H in this case. H is added to R, and the result of adding H to R is the teleprint code for V. So V is the first letter of the ciphertext, and that goes off into the radio. So that's how it worked. Why were there 5 chi wheels and 5 psi wheels? Well, each of the chi wheels produced a single bit, a 0 or a 1. And so you needed 5 wheels to produce a complete letter, because each letter was represented by 5 bits. So that's why there were 5 chi wheels, 5 psi wheels. And these wheels, of course, were always turning. Every time you pressed a new key at the keyboard, some or all of the wheels would move. So you were always getting different letters coming out of them. A seemingly random stream of letters would come out of the chi wheels and the psi wheels. So this is the machine that Max was confronted with when he came to Bletchley Park. No one had any idea how it worked. Nobody had even seen one. All they had was radio transmissions. With Enigma, they had an Enigma machine from the Poles before the war even started. And then they captured a lot more Enigma machines during the Norwegian campaign and the early months of the war. So people here had real Enigma machines on their desks. They could twiddle with them. They knew everything that there was to know about the hardware of an Enigma machine. Tunney was a complete blank. No tiny machines were captured, in fact, until 2 or 3 days before the end of the war. They had to proceed just by pure logic, by pure deduction. And that's where Bill Tutt enters the story, one of the greatest code breakers of all time. Tutt managed to reverse engineer the structure of the tunny machine. Just to do that would be remarkable enough, but it's even more remarkable when you hear that he managed to do that on the basis of just 2 intercepted messages. Just 2 scungy messages were enough for Tutt to be able to work out the entire structure of the tunny machine. He sat and he thought and he thought and he thought for weeks. He shared a room with my friend, the dear departed Jerry Roberts, and he said that Tutt just used to sit there staring into the middle distance and twiddling with his pencil. And Jerry wondered whether Tutt was really doing anything useful at all. But after all this thinking, Tutt suddenly announced that, well, the tunny machine had 12 wheels and these divide into 3 groups. And he said, I'm going to call the first group of 5 the chi wheels, and I'm going to call the second group of 5 the psi wheels, and I'm going to call the other 2 wheels the motor wheels. Here's what they all do. Basically, the description that I just gave you of how the tunny machine works, Tutt worked that out from these 2 intercepted messages, which were in fact really the same message. They were very similar messages set in depth, as the codebreakers say. And that was why Tutt was able to extract all this information from just 2 messages. They were 2 very special messages. But nevertheless, it was the greatest code-breaking feat of the Second World War, possibly the greatest code-breaking feat of all time. I mean, we don't know really what they've done since the end of the Second World War. There might be something even greater than what Tutt did, and we'll probably have to wait 50 years or so to find out. But as far as we know right now, this was the greatest code-breaking feat of all time. But there are 2 tasks that face a codebreaker in getting into a new cipher. The first task was to figure out how the new cipher machine worked. What was its internal structure? How did it do its stuff? And this Tutt had now done. But then the second job that needed doing was to come up with a method for breaking the daily messages produced by that machine. You could know everything that there was to know about the physical structure of a cipher machine, yet still not be able to break the messages that you were intercepting. Having an Enigma machine on your desk didn't necessarily help you to break Enigma messages. You needed to know other stuff, and you needed a method for breaking the daily messages. Tutt had kind of got to first base, but to do anything useful, they had to get to second base. And that's where Turing made his crucial contribution to Tunny. Turing came up with the first systematic method for reading the daily Tunny messages. In the kind of laconic jargon that they used here, they called it simply Turingery. They had this habit of naming bits of code-breaking technology after their inventors. And Turingery was the way in to Tunny. It was the only weapon that Tunny breakers had for about the first 8 months of the attack on Tunny. And it delivered over 1 million letters of plain text from Tunny messages. But it was what they called a hand method. It was like solving crossword puzzles. You kind of had sheets of paper with squares on, and you did stuff by hand. So it was relatively slow, relatively labor intensive. And also it required kind of human ingenuity. You had to make use of what you felt in your bones in order to apply Turingery. Tutt was actually quite rude about Turingery, quite sniffy. He said it was more artistic than mathematical. I guess there was a kind of rivalry between Turing and Tutt. I mean, Tutt had made this, great entrance. He produced the structure of the Tunny machine, yet couldn't actually break any messages, really. And then along came Turing, this kind of outsider, came up with this method that actually worked. So Tutt probably felt his thunder had been stolen a bit, and he sneered a bit about Turingery. What Tutt wanted was not a method where you had to steer by how you felt in your bones. He wanted a method that was completely mechanical for breaking tiny messages, a method that a machine could do. And so that was Tutt's next challenge to himself. And he did soon come up with such a method. It was a much better method for breaking tiny messages than Turing-Gry, although it was kind of based on Turing-Gry, it used many of the same techniques that Turing-Gry used, but it was very definitely an advance. But there was a snag. It required a large amount of very low-grade calculation to apply this method. It required so much low-grade calculation that if you did it by hand, as Turing-Gry was done, it would take years to break a single message. There was masses of calculation, just sort of adding zeros and ones and subtracting zeros and ones and so on. But there was just so much of it, it would take forever if you did it by hand. So although Tutte's method was ingenious and in principle a terrific method, it seemed that there was no way of using it in practice. And this is where Newman enters the picture. Tutte, who was a very quiet, shy guy, one day he was shyly explaining his new method to Newman, and Newman immediately suggested using electronic counters to speed up the process. Newman knew that in Cambridge, in the Cavendish Laboratory before the war, they'd used electronic counters to count emissions of subatomic particles, alpha particles and beta particles and so on. They'd figured out the technology for doing this in the Cavendish Laboratory. Newman knew about it. And in a flash of inspiration, he saw that this technology could be transferred to the completely different problem of doing the maths that Tutte's method required. It was an absolutely brilliant intervention on Newman's part. And once he explained it to the Bletchley Park top brass, probably with Turing's help, he got their support and they told him to go away and set up a machine section in order to implement Tutte's method by using electronics. And that was the Newman. That was how it started. We're in 1942 now. Newman's first machine, called Heath Robinson, it was installed in mid-1943, June 1943, and it was called the Heath Robinson, of course, after the famous British cartoonist Heath Robinson, who used to draw these contrivances that were sort of too ingenious to work. It was the Wrens, who the members of the Women's Royal Naval Service, who operated the Newmanry machines, who came up with the name Heath Robinson. I guess that's how Newman's machines seemed to them, just too ingenious to work. It did work, but never very well. It did manage to decode some messages, and it showed that Tutte's method could be used in practice and that the various mathematical functions that Tutte's method required could be done by a machine. It gave this sort of proof in principle, but it was slow and it was unreliable. The first time the Heath Robinson was switched on, smoke rose from the machinery. It was that kind of machine, a large resistor overloaded, and the engineers had to dive in and do some rewiring. It had these two paper tapes, these two bedsteads, as they used to call them. And one paper tape was the message that was to be attacked, punched into the tape in teleprinter code. And the other tape contained the entire stream of letters that the five Chi wheels would produce as they moved through all their possible positions. And what the Robinson did was compared the contents of these tapes and did addings and various other simple bits of maths with the binary digits on those tapes. But the tapes would often break. They were running at reasonably high speeds. They would often break as the Robinson was doing its calculations, and everyone in the room would be festooned with tiny shreds of torn tape. It would overheat, and it generally just wasn't very good. Robinson was working at least, but not working as well as they would like. At this point, Tom Flowers, the great electronic engineer, enters the story. Flowers pioneered digital electronics in the 1930s, before the Second World War, in connection with transferring telephone switchboards from relay-based equipment to electronic equipment. That was Flowers' great mission in life. He wanted to design and see installed all over Britain electronic telephone switchboards. And as I say, he pioneered digital electronics. He told me that when war broke out in 1939, he was probably the only person in Britain who understood that electronic valves could be used for high-speed digital computing. So when he was called here to assist Turing on the attack on Enigma, he turned out to be the right man in the right place at the right time. when Turing learned that they were having trouble with the design of Robinson, he recommended that Flowers be involved in the Tunney work. And so Flowers was shown the designs of Robinson. This was before they'd actually built one, but they were having trouble with designing the arithmetic unit of Robinson. And so Flowers was called in to improve things. He looked at the designs and he hated what he saw. He could see that Robinson would never work successfully. He thought the problem of keeping those two tapes in synchronization was unsolvable because the gizmos that drove the tapes would wear, and as the tapes span at high speed, they'd slowly slide out of synchronization. And as soon as they became desynchronized, then the Robinson would be counting the wrong things, so it could never produce the correct answer. So Flowers thought that's never going to work. Also, Robinson was mainly composed of relays. It did contain the electronics that Newman had suggested, but only for one stage of the process. There were only about 36 electronic valves in Robinson, and the rest of it was relays, these slow, clunky devices that Flowers was trying to banish from telephone exchanges, and they slowed everything down. So Flowers could see that Robinson was never going to give the code breakers the speed and the reliability that they needed. So he suggested to Newman that he should build, that Flowers should build an all-electronic machine to replace the Robinson. And Flowers suggested using about 2,000 electronic valves. This was a huge number. In those days, you know, a radio set might contain half a dozen or a dozen valves. And those were the sorts of numbers that people thought in terms of when they were designing valve equipment. Flowers came up with this astronomical figure of 2,000 valves. He knew he could make it work because he'd built installations of that size in his laboratory in London before the war. Newman was kind of taken aback by the breathtaking scale of Flowers' suggestion, and he took advice from other engineers. And they kind of said, well, don't listen to this lunatic Flowers. 2,000 valves, it'll never work. Valves are too unreliable. You'll never be able to get 2,000 of them working reliably together. Forget it. Don't touch it with a barge pole. So Newman carried on with the Robinson. But he had faith in Flowers, despite the advice that he'd received. And so he said, look, if you think you can do it, just go away and build it. I'll tell you what you need to know. I'll tell you how we're doing with the attack on Tunney. I'll give you all the code-breaking parameters that you need in order to build Colossus. Just do it, and let's see if it works. And that's exactly what they did. Flowers went back to his laboratory in London and just quietly got on with building the all-electronic machine that he knew the code-breakers needed. Newman set aside space in the Newman Reef for Colossus once it arrived, and rather eagerly awaited the arrival of what he referred to as Mr. Flowers' ambitious machine, he called it. And then one day, early in January 1944, some of Flowers' lads turned up with the first large-scale electronic computer ever to be built on the back of a lorry. They just drove up to Bletchley Park with this huge machine on the back of their truck. It was unloaded, installed. It took them a few days, you know, to get all the separate sections wired together and to get the electronics ticking over. And then they brought the code breakers in to see this new marvel. And the code breakers were astonished by what they saw, by the sheer speed of Colossus. And also, according to the contemporary accounts, by the fact that Colossus would produce the same answer if set the same problem twice. So you can infer that Robinson didn't do that. Flowers Colossus. It was aptly named. It was the size of a room. It weighed about a ton. You can, of course, see the wonderful Colossus rebuild that they've got here. Just one tape. Flowers knew that the two-tape system would never work, and so he used electronics to set up the other data stream internally. So the letters that the Chi wheels produced as they turned, that data stream was set up internally using rings of valves, so only one tape was needed. There were two sections involved in the attack on Tunney. There was the Newmanry with the Colossi, and what the Newmanry did was they used the Colossi to strip off the layer of encryption that was supplied by the Chi wheels, that first layer of encryption. So that's what the Colossi did. They scrubbed the Chi layer of encryption off the coded message. and produced what was called a Dekai. So the Dekai was the German plain text encoded only by the letters produced by the psi wheels. So the Dekai was then passed on to another section, a neighbouring section, known as the Testery. It was named after its leader, Ralph Tester. And in the Testery, Jerry Roberts and his fellow codebreakers would strip off the remaining layer of encryption in order to reveal the plain German. That was a much easier proposition than stripping off the Chi encryption. The Psi encryption was so relatively easy to break that they did it by hand. They didn't need colossi in the Testery. But anyway, that's how the system went. The messages, the encrypted messages, would be received from the Y stations. They'd be sent to the numinary. The numinary would use the colossi to strip off the Chi encryption. The Dekai would be passed to the Testery. The Testery breakers would get enough short breaks into the plain text for the settings on which the message had been encrypted to be worked out. And then the Dekai would be fed into British tunny machines that they had in the Testery, and the British tunny machines would take off the psi layer and reveal the German plain text. And there's a rebuild of a British tunny machine that you can see here as well, quite different to the German tunny machine. It's huge, it looks completely different to the German tunny machine. It's the same logic, and that's what they used to do that final stage of decryption. Thanks to Colossus and the numinary and the Testery, the British had an unrivaled view of the German army and of the intentions of the German commanders before and during and after the D-Day landings. Even with that amazing amount of information about German strategy, German positions, and so on, it still took the Allies the best part of a year to fight their way from the Normandy beaches to Berlin. Imagine how much longer it would have taken if they hadn't had Colossus. Maybe twice as long, maybe even longer. Nobody knows. There's no real way of calculating how much longer it would have taken, but for sure it would have taken longer. And you can equate that to additional numbers of lives lost. At a conservative estimate, each year of the war was costing about 7 million lives. So if Colossus shortened the war by even only 12 months, then that's 7 million lives saved. That's a figure that I find much easier to say than to imagine. 7 million people, 7 million lives. It's quite different to visualize. But whichever way you look at it, a large number of people owed their lives to Newman's computers.
So the end of a very lovely sunny day at Bletchley Park. It's been very busy today, and a lot of those people came to see our latest speaker in the Bletchley Park Presents series of lectures. He's one of the leading experts on what happened here during World War II. And also, he's very good at telling stories about some of those codebreakers and some of those people that people don't really know about. Why was Max so important, Jack?
Well, he was one of the people who broke Tunny. Tunny was kind of super Enigma. More secure than Enigma, much more sophisticated, came along partway through the war. And breaking Tunny was the main problem that Bletchley Park faced from 1941 onwards. And Newman headed the attack on Tunny.
You've especially done so much work on Tunny and Colossus, haven't you? I mean, you've written the definitive book, as far as I'm concerned, on Colossus. Last year you were here talking about Tommy Flowers, the father of Colossus, really. And now Max Newman. It's another part of that story, isn't it, that unfortunately people are only just beginning to learn about?
Yes, well, Tunny was classified for much longer than Enigma, and it was really only in 2000 that the key documents about Tunny were declassified. And even now it's not all in the public domain, quite a lot still classified. So, yeah, the Tunny story is broken much later than the Enigma story and more slowly. And the key players were Max Newman and Tommy Flowers and Bill Tutt. These are all names that are not as well known as Alan Turing's name now and the attack on Enigma. Although Turing did play a crucial part in the attack on Tunny as well. That's often not realised.
That was an early sort of theoretical...
Well, practical as well. It was due to a method that Turing invented called Turingry that they were first able to read the Tunny traffic. And Turingry was their only weapon. against Honey for about the first 8 months of the attack, and they decoded over 1 million letters of code using Turing's method. Sort of in the sort of standard cartoon Turing picture, he had nothing to do with Tunny. Enigma was his great thing. And of course, he did do great work on Enigma, but the work he did on Tunny was of equal importance to what he did on Enigma.
And there's a good connection between Max and Alan, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, they go way back. Turing was originally Max's student in Cambridge before the war. Turing attended lectures by Newman on the foundations of mathematics. And it was actually Newman who sort of nudged Turing into the direction of development that led to the universal Turing machine and the modern computer.
Did he help with the publishing of the 1936 paper?
He did. He was the first person to see a draft of the 1936 paper. Turing just sort of knocked on Newman's door one day and handed him this great, you know, sheaf of papers. And this was a draft of Turing's brilliant paper on computable numbers, where he resolved the Hilbert decision problem and also set out the fundamental logical principles of the modern computer. You know, an incredible paper, one of the greatest landmarks in human intellectual history, that paper. And he just handed it to Newman in sort of undigested form. Must have blown Newman's mind when he read it. There was just so much in it. But one of the results in it was that Hilbert's decision problem, as it was called, was unsolvable. And unfortunately, an American by the name of Alonzo Church had also proved that result and published it. So there was some question about whether Turing's paper could be published, because, you know, once a result has been published in mathematics, you don't republish it. They kind of think once is enough.
You don't get cover versions, do you?
You don't, no. So, you know, Newman kind of thought about it, and he decided that there was plenty in Turing's paper, you know, over and above the result that Church had already got. So he wrote to the editor of the Proceedings of the London Mathematical Society and said, look, it's a pity that this guy in America has preempted part of this paper, but there's so much else in it that Church never got anywhere near that you should publish it anyway. The editor believed Max, fortunately, and so Turing's paper was published. And it does, of course, go way beyond what Church did. Church got just a tiny corner of the picture that Turing uncovered in his paper.
What I especially like about Max's story is actually his background.
He was born in Britain, but his father was German, born in Germany. The family name was Neumann, and they changed the name to Neumann in the First World War by deed poll. So Max was half German.
And his mother, Sarah, was English, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was from Somerset, I think.
An Anglo-German son ends up helping England during the Second World War in really fundamental ways.
Yes, and he was terrified about possibly being drafted in the First World War because, you know, being of German origin, if he was taken prisoner, you know, he knew what might befall him. So he was fortunate to avoid the fighting in the First World War. Then he was, in the Second World War, one of the people most directly responsible for defeating Hitler.
It's a remarkable story, and it didn't end there, did it? Because after the war, he moved to Manchester and became a leading light in the burgeoning world of electronic brains, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, that's right. Well, it was his involvement here that sort of got him into it. He was already interested from reading Turing's paper in 1936, you know, because Turing described the modern computer, essentially. And Turing and Newman as well could both see the potential. They were both itching to build one of these things. And then here, of course, Newman was involved with Colossus and digital electronics. Colossus was the first large-scale electronic computer, but not quite yet a modern computer, because it didn't involve the stored program concept that Turing had introduced in the 1936 paper. So when the war ended, the next step was to build kind of a stored program version of Colossus, a true modern computer. And that's what both Turing and Newman couldn't wait to do when the war ended. And Turing went to London to the National Physical Laboratory and designed his ACE, and Newman went to Manchester, and there was the Manchester baby, the first electronic universal Turing machine, the first modern computer.
Which led on to the Ferranti 1, wasn't it?
The Ferranti Mark 1, yeah, the first stored program computer to go on the market. It's usually said that the first machine was the American UNIVAC, but in fact, the Ferranti Mark 1 was a few weeks before.
We know the truth.
We know the truth, yes.
Thank you so much for helping to spread the stories and the histories of these vitally important people, because Alan Turing's story's out there, and it's good that people now know that, but now our job is to start telling people about some of these other heroes, really, isn't it?
Yes, Max Newman, Bill Tutt, Ralph Tester. There are so many people whose names are not really there in popular history. They will be. Turing's a great model. You know, he was unknown for many years, but thanks to St. Benedict, now everyone knows who Turing was. And now it's the turn of some of the others.
Who's going to be next?
Oh, well, I think...
And we'll hold you to it.
I think Tommy Flowers and Max Newman need a bit of a push.
You're already helping with both of those. You did a wonderful talk on Tommy last year and today's talk on Max. So
thank you.
Thank you very much, Jack.
Thanks.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.